This is Cassette Colloquia, a continuing series of audio tapes containing current information on broad technical subjects of interest to electrical and electronic engineers. This talk was recorded on September 13, 1969, at the Systems Technology Session sponsored by the IEEE Cedar Rapids Section Conference on Applications of New Electronics Technology. Mr. Neil Blake is a technical advisor, FAA Air Traffic Control Development Division. He spoke on future air traffic control systems. A pilot himself, Mr. Blake has done considerable flying for the FAA. Prior to 1966, he was a member of the systems design team concerned with the major airspace plan now in use. He holds the bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering from Yale. The Department of Transportation Air Traffic Control Advisory Committee has just completed a study of means and needs for future air traffic control systems. Special consideration was directed at three major areas identified in the current third-generation air traffic control system. First, saturation during peak hours at major terminals. Second, the increasing threat of mid-air collision in mixed airspace. And finally, the increasing cost of the air traffic control system. Mr. Blake will describe and clarify the tentative conclusions drawn by this committee. Mr. Blake.
It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm very happy that you invited me and that Dr. Goldmunts couldn't come. It's true, in the agency, when we fly the aircraft, they send two pilots. We meet all the airline requirements, and then we have a few additional ones of our own. It got to be kind of a joke whenever the other pilot said, "Wouldn't you like to fly the next leg?" I didn't have to talk to the weatherman. I knew it was right down on the deck. Now, the ATC Advisory Committee was formed by the Department of Transportation in the summer of 1968, and they submitted their report to the Secretary in August of this year. The report represented a study of the ATC traffic forecast for the period from now through 1995, a review of the agency's automation program. It contains a design approach for the improvement of the automation system so that the traffic forecast for 1995 can be handled. And in addition, it defines the research and development program which is necessary to support the development of the new system. Now, the committee, whose names are on the view graph, was a very active committee in that the members of the committee participated in the many study efforts that were conducted under their direction. Ben Alexander is the chairman of the group, and he's also the chairman of the board and technical director of the General Research Corporation. Dr. Tom Amley is the technical director of the Naval Weapons Center in China Lake. Jim Densmore is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Research and Technology of the Department. Bob Everett is the President of MITRE. Dr. Glazer is the Director of the Jennings Computer Center and a very forward-looking person in the computer area. Dr. Goldmunts works in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Research and Technology and was the extremely hard-working Executive Secretary for our group. Dick Huff, who you may remember generated the Beacon Report several years back, is Vice President of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Dr. John Meyer, an economist and President of the National Bureau of Economic Research. Dr. Perkins, who is the Chairman of the Department of Aerospace and Mechanical Sciences at Princeton. Dr. Rowena, Vice President for Special Laboratories, MIT. And General J. Francis Taylor, retired, President of Aeronautical Radio, Incorporated. Now, the committee conducted a detailed analysis of the present ATC system and identified the problems existing in that system, examined the forecast demand for services by the users through 1995. In examining that forecast, they expect the traffic to double about every 10 years, but the demand for services in the next 10 years is expected to increase by an order of magnitude, which puts a severe load on our present system. They evaluated alternative approaches for improving the system and conducted the study effort necessary to define the requirements and the design approach to be taken in upgrading our present systems. The areas where the committee concentrated their effort were three: increasing terminal capacity, increasing air safety, and increasing the capacity of the airspace system in the high-density areas, while limiting the rapidly rising cost of staffing the present system. The present FAA program for the automation of the en route and terminal areas, called respectively the NAS program and the ARTS program, is based on meeting the traffic demands from now through 1979. If no further automation is undertaken than that which is in our present program, the cost of operating the system for control personnel alone, the increased cost will be $1 billion by 1980, roughly double the current expenditure. Now, in addition, the study pointed out that the system will be saturated by 1980 in the major terminal areas with this level of automation, and it will be necessary to constrain traffic flow in these areas if no further automation is undertaken. So the two factors, saturation of the system and the tremendously fast rise in the cost of operating the system, led the committee to the conclusion that automation was not a luxury, but was absolutely required for the future success of our system. The committee, in order to carry out their work, established the staff. Those are the people that do the work. And the staff consisted of about 25 people from the agency, the Department of Defense, and NASA. And they were supported by approximately 150 people whose time was donated by industry. Two people from Collins were most helpful to us in this study, John Holt and Gene Martin. Now, Group 1 was charged with studying the capacity which presently exists at our major airport. And they examined what improvements could be made through the use of improved runway and taxiway design, improved airport surface design, by instituting new procedures, and by adding full automation to the terminal area. And we'll look briefly at the recommendations of this group in a minute. The second group was the automation group. We called it Decreasing Reliance on Human Factors. That's a good political title. We had really three major efforts under it. One was to determine where the present system saturated, and we call this an airspace group. We had a data acquisition group whose whole purpose in life was to examine the various approaches possible to us for improving the accuracy and the reliability of the data which we feed into our automation system. And a computer sizing group that had an enormous task to do, as they had to define the algorithms or the approach to performing each of the automation functions which the committee recommended for inclusion in the future system. Having defined them, they had to simulate them and to estimate the size of the program in instructions per second. Compare this summation with the technology which was forecast for the time period and to conclude whether it was or was not feasible to do it. The third group was concerned with safety of the airspace. And they conducted a detailed analysis of the mid-air collisions and collision situations. They generated a model which allows one to forecast the most probable collision rate over the next few years. And they concluded that a new service must be provided by the ATC system, namely the provision of a digital data link to all aircraft operating in controlled airspace, through which one would provide collision avoidance vectors. And we'll look at this in some detail in a minute. The fourth group was concerned with upgrading our forecast of the future traffic demand on the system. Well, most of the groups turned out reports which would fill about 2 feet of the bookshelf. This one, thank heavens, only filled several inches. The report at the present time has reached a volume of some 300 pages, and the supporting studies and appendices exceed 3,000. And this represents only a small part of the work that was actually done. The fifth group was the system engineering group, and they considered four different system approaches in some depth. And there was a working group for each of these systems. The first one considers delegated as much responsibility to the aircraft cockpit and to the pilot as was possible. Now, the group that worked in this area finally concluded, however, that the sequencing of traffic, the advanced flow planning of traffic, must be done on the ground. They concluded that the navigation must remain in the cockpit, and they recommended that some of the separation assurance be done in the cockpit. The other three systems were what we call central management type. They all relied heavily on a ground located air traffic control system. And they differed, the three approaches differed mostly in the type of data acquisition system used to provide the data to the computers on the ground. The first one looked at was a satellite system. And while the satellite offers better coverage to lower altitudes and the possibility of measuring altitude to 100 feet directly, we could not find during the course of the study any technology which would allow us to control 50,000 aircraft simultaneously, which is the number of aircraft demanding service in 1995. The committee concluded, however, that studies should be continued in this area to develop the necessary technology for implementation around the turn of the century. The other two ground systems differed only in the data acquisition area. One was based on determining aircraft position through trilateration computation and was based on the use of time frequency technology. The other system modified the present ATC radar beacon system to become a discrete address roll call data link system operating on the beacon frequency. After considerable study, the distinctions between the systems turned out to be rather negligible. Some functions were assigned to the cockpit, the navigation and landing guidance. Some were assigned to the ground, that is, the control, the advanced planning, the sequence. So the differences finally resolved down to whether the separation or station keeping function should be done on the ground or done in the air. Now, the equipment and procedures required for both approaches were examined, and the committee concluded that since air traffic control was really the control of many aircraft by a single facility, and that the separation function was better performed on the ground, it resulted in less equipment being required in the aircraft. And this was the approach that they selected. Now, getting back to the work of three of the groups, the first group, again, was working on increasing the capacity of our present airport system. They considered three different runway configurations: the conventional runway with a 40-mile-an-hour turnoff shown at the top, an improved runway shown in the middle. The left end, you have a sort of a launching ramp for departures. They can be in position ready to go on the diagonal. As soon as the aircraft has landed and turned off from the runway, then the departure can be released and some improvement in rate is possible. And the bottom one, which was finally recommended for implementation, is the dual-lane runway. It consists of two runways 700 feet apart. The bottom runway is the departure runway, and the upper runway is the arrival runway. The method of operation is that departure is in position, and as soon as the arrival is committed and has landed, then the departure is released. There is that degree of dependence. Now, this chart shows the impact of really three different things which can be done to increase capacity. The first, we've examined the impact of various runway configurations. And if you'll follow across the top line, we took data from our present operation and we tabulated it both for arrivals and mixed arrival and departure situations as a function of the three runway types which we saw on the previous slide. We then computed what these numbers should be based on our separation standards. And you can see that the controllers are cheating a little in the first case. Then we said we can achieve, by doing this, a 40% increase in traffic handling capacity by doing nothing other than changing the pavement. We then said, what is the impact of adding automation? The first one examined was the case where the computer aided the manual system and told the controller what headings, when to reduce speed, when to change altitude, but the controller transmitted the message directly to the pilot over the voiced link. There was some improvement. We felt we could achieve an accuracy or a standard deviation of 11 seconds, plus or minus, in delivering aircraft to the runway. We next added a digital data link, which was capable of feeding the same information directly to the pilot or to the autopilot, and we felt we could achieve a much improved standard deviation of 5 seconds. Well, the impact of this type of automation is to give one a 35% approximately increase over what one could do with pavement alone. We then conducted a risk study. This was based on having a certain level of automation. It was based on having computer surveillance of the final approach areas, and the figures came out that it is in fact safe to reduce spacing when you can in fact control that spacing. So we reduced the spacing between aircraft on approach from 3 down to the normal runway occupancy time, or 2 mile spacing, whichever was larger, and achieved another 35% increase in the traffic capacity. If all of these changes are implemented, the increase from where we are today to where we could be quite feasibly by 1980 is about 160%, and the Group 1 activity ended with a recommendation that these changes be made to the system. Now, some detailed effort was conducted to find what the right value was for the standard deviation. This graph shows the delivery accuracy to the gate. Now, the gate is a position approximately 6 miles from the touchdown point on the runway. At the bottom are the errors which we feel are reasonable for our present system and for a future automated system. We held 3 of these constant and varied the other, and you can see the sensitivity to delivery error of varying the various parameters. Our conclusion was that we could limit this error, that is, delivery to the gate, to about plus or minus 4 seconds. Now we have to get from the gate to touchdown, and Boeing ran some rather detailed simulations for us under various conditions. We have the manual system, the pilot flying in still air and with turbulence and wind shear, and we have various auto-throttle, autopilot combinations flying under the same conditions. You can see that the present auto-throttle is slightly better than the man. These are seconds, of course, of delivery error. We looked at the Doppler ground speed system presented both to the pilot and to the autopilot. Inertial ground speed, DME ground speed. A readout of distance, which you'll see gave poorer results across the board, and precision DME ground speed that showed a slight improvement. We said in looking at these, we feel that the runout error from the gate to touchdown is about 3 seconds, and if you root sum square that with the previous figure, you come out with the 5 second number that the committee has been using. We did one further thing. This is in the category of sensitivity analysis. The missed approach rate is a critical item in establishing the buffer, which is to be added to the runway occupancy time in order to determine what your landing rate will be. One of the curves, and this perhaps is a significant one, it assumes that an aircraft, the time it crosses the threshold until it is off the runway, ties up that facility for approximately 60 seconds. With the assumption that automation then adds a 5 second error, one can derive the landing rate in arrivals per hour. Now, the bottom curve is aircraft actually landed, and the upper curve is aircraft, the difference between them, or the aircraft that went around. Well, since these have to get back into the system, you really have to subtract them from this curve. And our conclusion was that the proper number to be used for scheduling is about the 1% level, one missed approach per hour, maximum. There was no gain in trying to put them closer together. Now, in examining the various alternatives for increasing terminal capacity, it became apparent that it is far easier and quicker to expand airports than to build new ones. The electro-political problems involved in the latter one are enormous, and it takes decades, not years, to solve them. However, in many areas, both expansion and new airports are required. Our present separation standard for independent approaches is 5,000 feet between runways. This takes a lot of real estate when you talk about adding another runway. Now, the committee, therefore, determined in their study what minimum runway spacing could provide safety at least equivalent to today, and what system improvements were required in order to achieve the reduced separation with equivalent safety. The improvements they recommended were the installation of a scanning beam microwave landing system, which potentially reduces the deviations on final approach by a ratio of 2-to-1 over our present system. They recommended a far more accurate data acquisition system capable of establishing aircraft position to about 100 feet at the approach gate. They indicated that a digital data link was required and that a fully automatic sequencing and spacing program was required. Now, since the data which we have available on approach deviations is somewhat limited and taken mainly at O'Hare, the group that worked on the risk calculation assumed a Gaussian distribution. And this is a very conservative assumption, since the surveillance and control process acts to truncate the tails of the distribution. Now, the control process is always acting to maximize the landing rate and to minimize the missed approaches. Now, a study of a model of the improved system forecasts the risk as a function of runway separation, and that is the tabulation on the view graph. And from this analysis, it appeared that a runway separation of 2,500 feet was safe as today. Now, it was recognized, however, that user acceptance may be highly contingent on having displays in the cockpit which show the pilot as well as the controller, and at the same time as the controller, any deviations of aircraft on adjacent runways. Now, one of the bad features of landing more aircraft is you have a lot more noise. And there was a group that worked for a considerable period of time, and they took several representative high-density airports and redesigned them to incorporate all of the improvements that I mentioned a moment ago, which are required to improve the capacity. And they also laid out the approach and departure paths to reduce the noise exposure to the population around the airport. This is one of the layouts, and it's for Kennedy Airport in New York. The present airport is in this area. These are extensions of existing runways. These are new ones out in Jamaica Bay. Through the use of the scanning beam microwave landing system and of a curved path computer in the aircraft, it is possible to define approach and departure paths where you're making 1/2 G turns that become straight lines 2 miles from the airport to allow the aircraft autopilot to stabilize for a normal landing. Now, these are representative of the type of work that was done by the group, and I'd like to show you the impact on the noise generated by the present configuration and also the new one. Now, we have a thing we call a noise exposure figure, and the values 30 and 40 are related to the normal noise measurements in EPNDB, that's effective perceived noise in decibels. We've taken off the multiplying factor. The significant thing is a level of 30, one gets expressions of individual dislike all the way up to concerted group action to close the airport. And at levels of 40 and above, you get concerted, highly volatile town meeting, women pushing baby carriages down the runway, and various other expressions of distaste for the noise. So we took these two levels as kind of a way of measuring the effectiveness of the noise reduction program. The top half of the graph concerns itself with Kennedy as it is and with its expansion to 1979 for a traffic level of 790,000 operations per year. Now, with the current fleet, no modifications, no nothing, these are the square miles affected, and these are the millions of people affected. With our present noise abatement procedures, we do practically nothing to reduce the noise exposure, but everyone feels better because they know we have noise abatement procedures. If we now retrofit the four-engine jet fleet with the quiet nacelles which have been developed and essentially eliminate compressor noise on approach and reduce by 10 or 15 dB the noise of the departures, we do begin to see some reduction in the exposure both in square miles and the people who live there. Now, all the time our traffic is expanding, the population is expanding, so that we don't get as direct a reduction. between the present population and the future one exposed. And here we've combined the two. There's the power cut and the retrofitted fleet, and these really do something for you. That's with Kennedy as it is. With the new runways out in Jamaica Bay, we get a much better situation if we did nothing else. And this always becomes a problem. Since the aircraft people and owners have to fix their airplane, the city of New York has to build new runways, the attitude is, well, you get some improvement for each of these things, so let the other guy do it. So we took a look. You suppose only one of the parties agreed to do something. This assumes we have a new runway configuration. We add noise abatement procedures. This assumes that we also get the air carrier to do something, and we still have noise abatement procedures. And the figures to compare are today's population exposure and tomorrow. These are the mad people. Remember, these are the baby buggies on the runway.
Now, turn the cassette over for part two of this program.